And welcome back in Stripe Show Podcast. I'm your host, Travis Fulton. Thank you for making us part of your day. We're rolling along here. Middle of October. Great to see some beautiful golf on Golf Channel. I really enjoyed the CJ Cup. Beautiful Shadow Creek out there in Las Vegas. I guess that would be one of the silver linings. We get to see some courses like this that we normally wouldn't see. No fans. Very private facility. Just looked absolutely gorgeous on TV. And of course, Jason Kokrak gets his first win on the PGA Tour to help us break it all down. He was there. He lived it on site for the Golf Channel analyst and announcer, Kurt Byron. Kurt, thanks for joining us here on the podcast.
It's good to be with you, Travis. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. Well, you got to tell us about the golf course first. It looked beautiful. I thought, from what I could see, it played extremely well. I heard a few guys talk about the rough maybe was a little too long. What was your take?
Yeah, I think overall the players liked it pretty well. Feedback that I got and the players that I spoke to, it was pretty much all positive. You know, there were probably a couple greens that got maybe just a little too firm for their liking, but it's just such a gorgeous place, you know, just plopped down there in that North Las Vegas area, which was, you know, obviously just complete rough desert back in the day in 1990 when they opened that thing. But I think the players really liked it. I thought it was pretty straightforward. There weren't any real tricks to the golf course. You had to drive it in the fairway. You could not play from the rough. The rough is that overseeded rye, which this time of year everybody out here is doing. And, you know, with good weather and water on it at night, it was growing like crazy. So by the end of the week, it was probably close to 5 inches. And it really created some issues for the players. But if they drove it well and they drove it in the fairway, you could absolutely play from there. And I think that, you know, you saw that in the scores that got shot Sunday. Some guys went for big numbers, but a guy like, you know, Kokrak shot 64. So it was there. It was pretty much right in front of you. I thought the design held up. You know, they did some modifications to the golf course, I think, back in 2008 or 9. It was originally opened in 1990. So, but they, you know, with the tee boxes and everything, there was enough length. You know, of course, the ball flies so far out there at that 2,000 elevation plus 90-degree temperature. So, but I think overall, the golf course was just, it's spectacular looking. It's just a really cool place. You know, obviously, a lot of people have not been able to play there because of, you know, as exclusive as it is. But it was fun to be able to sort of expose it to the world that really hasn't gotten a good look at it.
Yeah. Well, normally when you go there and play the golf course, you have to take a limo in. No one drives their own car. And now I'd imagine that was different for the course or for the tournament, right? Not everybody was just rolling up in limos, right?
No. I did see the MGM, limo in and out of there quite a bit, but the players all had their cars, their Genesis cars. And then of course, you know, the Golf Channel has its compound over there. So, you know, and PGA Tour Live had their, you know, they were in the same compound as we were. So they're, but not really anywhere near the clubhouse. I mean, we were off in a dirt parking lot on the side of the golf course, which is where we should be. And, you know, with no crowds there, no galleries there, it was pretty limited, but it was really well run. I mean, they know how to operate there at Shadow Creek, as well as, you know, the tour is at this point is pretty efficient in how they take care of things.
Well, Jason Kokrak gets his first win, 233 starts. I think he's made like over, you know, $13 million playing the game. He's been on the scene for 10 years. Yep. And when I look at Kokrak over this period of time, I mean, if you compared his game to other PGA Tour players, right, this is PGA Tour standard. You know, he's a long hitter, you know, and always has been, 6'4", 220 pounds. He can get it out there. I would say solid approach game, you know, maybe subpar around the greens when compared to other tour players and perhaps an inconsistent putter. But this week, I mean, he careered it on the greens, Kurt. 10.3 strokes gained putting, his best ever in his career. That's my take with Kokrak. How would you assess him during his tenure on tour?
Yeah, I think pretty spot on. I think, he's always been a very good driver of the golf ball. When you combine his length with his relative accuracy, I mean, he's not, you know, he's not Fred Funk accuracy, but he's, you know, when you're hitting it, and when that club's going as fast as it is for Kokrak, you know, it's easy to hit it well offline, which he does not do. He drives it really well. And really, I think that was a key for him on Sunday. Mm-hmm. The putting was amazing. I mean, he, you know, I think the stat for last year, if I remember right, was he ranked 151st on the PGA Tour in strokes gained putting. So the real key, two keys for him that week were the drive the ball in the fairway, because you had to play from the fairway to be able to spin the ball enough to hold the greens. And then from there, he made everything he looked at. He was amazing. He led the field in strokes gained putting. It was just a phenomenal performance. And I really do think he's maybe a better fast green putter. The greens were 13 on the stimp meter. They're bent. They were in perfect shape. And I think he's better when he's able to take high lines, play a lot of break, and dive the ball into the hole. And I think that helped as far as his putting goes. But, you know, you probably know Drew Steckel. Steckel's been coaching him now for a few years. And I think through Steckel, he's been able to refine his swing a little bit so it's more consistent. I think that's helped his approach game quite a bit. His iron game was really, really good. He just was in control of his ball the whole way around. And, you know, the one thing that maybe we should have talked more about on the air was that he's an MGM ambassador. And so he's been out there a lot. He lives, I think he's living in Cleveland these days. And so when he needs to get away to get some good weather to practice, a lot of times he goes to Las Vegas and he has free run of Shadow Creek when he's there. So I think the course knowledge and having a really solid game plan for that golf course was a big help as well.
You could see this coming, this good play. I mean, you know, it'd be hard to predict that he was going to win since he, you know, didn't have a win up to this point. But, you know, 15th at the Wyndham, 13th at the Northern Trust, 6th at the BMW. I mean, he finished 17th at the U.S. Open.
Yeah.
And to your point with Drew, you can see it too. Strokes gained tee to green. It has improved. He hasn't lost strokes tee to green since July. His approach game has been, I would say, again, solid, even subtle improvements here and there in around the green. But the big difference, of course, when you get into the positive 10 in any statistical category, that's a huge week. And it'll be interesting to see how he, you know, what this does for him and maybe kind of spins him forward and gives him the confidence to clip off another one. But second place, of course, was Xander. But the guy that finished T3rd, I want to ask you about Tyrrell Hatton. For those that follow my podcast, they know that, you know, I've been a big fan of Tyrrell Hatton for a couple years. I've said I think he's one of the most underrated players in the game. He's currently 9th in the official world golf rankings. You look at him statistically, you can't really take the sample size for just this year. There's not a lot of rounds. But, I mean, these stats, I'm going to read them off to you, Kurt. Strokes gained off the tee, 64th. Approach, 4th. Around the green, 42nd. Putting, 34th. You know, tee to green, 13th. Total, 8th. And this is a guy that has no weaknesses. And what's the ceiling for him as you watch him play?
Well, you covered it pretty well there. I think the ceiling is really high for that guy for all of the reasons that you mentioned. And he's, you know, the thing that I didn't realize, I think, is that, and stats don't always tell this because, you know, he may be hitting a lot of three woods off the tee or laying up on holes where other guys are hitting drivers or whatever. But he's got some length. He's getting it out there right now. And part of that, I think, is he's playing with so much confidence right now. And there really isn't a weakness. I knew he could really putt. He's always been able to really putt. And I think, you know, the stats wise, you know, it'll be more clear the more he plays over here. You know, he still goes and plays a lot back at home in Europe. And so those stats aren't as in depth as our strokes gain stats over here. So we're going to learn more and more about him, but I don't think he has really any holes in his game either. And I think, you know, people would say, yeah, but he's, you know, he's so demonstrative and so, you know, he gets all ticked off so easy. And, but it's almost like it's just kind of part of him, you know, it's almost like a show a little bit. It's not a, he knows that it's being shown on TV. He knows people laugh at it. And he, I mean, he's not dumb. He knows all that stuff's out there on TV every week. But, you know, from the mental side of that, the one thing that he doesn't do, like, you know, I don't know what round, I think it was Saturday, he hit a second shot in the fairway on 10, and he did the club flip down the fairway, and then he kicked down the fairway a few more times before he finally picked it up, you know, and you thought, oh man, if you didn't know who Terrell Hatton was, you'd think, oh yeah, this guy's done. Like, there's no way he gets his mind back into the game. But by the time he gets to the green and has this, whatever it was, chip, bunker shot, whatever he had left there, I can't remember for sure, but you know, he's back, he's focused. That was just like, for 2 or 3 minutes, he loses his mind. And then when he gets to the ball, he's fine. And I think that's why he continues to play well, because he really doesn't, you know, some guys, when they lose their mind and they start throwing clubs and banging their bag, you know, that carries over for two holes. And by that time they've made a double, they've made another bogey. Hatton doesn't do that. You know, he shows his emotions, you know, it looks terrible on TV sometimes, but it makes me laugh every time I see it. I know. Would it not be the greatest thing ever to have a microphone on him for 18 holes? I know he'd never do it, but how entertaining would that be? But it's he's a piece of work, and I love his game just like you. I think he's got a very high ceiling. The way the guy putts, I mean, you just never know. A place like Augusta National, where you have to be able to putt the ball, I mean, it could be right up his alley. Who knows?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, he's always been that world-class putter, and I think he's kind of reeled it in a little bit from his ball striking standpoint over the last couple years. But yeah, I mean, it just feels like some of the antics that he does have on the course, if a Bryson or a Brooks, you know, it would come down, I think, with much harsher criticism, right? But for some reason, it lands a little bit differently with him. And man, is there any way we can make that happen to get a microphone on him? I mean, because that would be phenomenal. It really would. That would be amazing to watch. Even if it's a Wednesday deal, Kurt, like, you know, for charity.
Yeah.
I mean, just serve that up.
Oh, God, it'd be awesome.
For us, because he is, he's fun to watch. He's in the field this week. Zozo Championship. Of course, Tiger is the defending champion. And I was looking at the field and just kind of looking over these players, and I want to throw a few names at you as we look at this field. Obviously, a lot of guys are playing some good golf heading in, but I always like to ask guys like you, some guys that, you know, you look at, some more obvious than others, that are not playing good golf. And I would, for me, a deeper level of concern, the most obvious is Spieth. He's now down to 75 in the official world golf rankings. He was 38th at the CJ Cup. He did play better on the weekend, but you look deeper, he still lost strokes statistically from his ball striking standpoint. How do you view it right now when you look at Jordan? We're going on the better part of 3 years of really playing un-Jordan-like type of golf.
Yeah, it's not fun to watch a guy who, you know, you used to watch, and every time he was in contention, you knew he was going to have a chance. It's really tough to watch. It's, you know, I watched him warm up at CJ Cup this past week, one of the days, and he had a great warm up. I mean, really, really solid all the way through the bag. And I stuck around to watch driver in particular to see what he was doing. And the only time I could see that he would get in trouble with the driver when he was warming up, and, you know, he's loose, there's, you know, no concerns where you're hitting it and all that, and I get that. But to me, the only time he got in trouble was when he would try to play a draw. And I know he likes to play a draw. He did in the past when he was winning all those tournaments. But when he would just, you know, really turn hard through the ball and not get stuck behind with too much bend in his right side trying to hit that draw, when he would turn hard through it and hit a cut or a straight ball to a cut, it really looked good. And I guess that's my takeaway from watching him last week, is that it's almost like, have one miss, you know what I mean? I mean, if you're missing it both ways, you've got serious problems if you're trying to play the PGA Tour. If you have one miss, at least you can aim for that. You can aim down the right side and play a draw. If it hooks, you still might keep it in the fairway on the left side, and vice versa. You aim down that left side, and if you're overcutting it, you still have 35 yards of fairway. You still might get in the right side. If you're hitting it great, it peels 2 yards, and you're in the middle of the fairway. But I feel like that's part of it, maybe, that he needs to figure out one shot and play that a little more often. But I think the confidence factor is just gone right now. It just isn't there anymore. And whether changes need to be made, you know, that's a tough call. You know, you teach players, he's been with Cameron McCormick a long time, but I will say this, sometimes a new set of eyeballs and somebody else, you know, talking in your ear about something a little different or presenting it a little different way, sometimes that works.
Yeah.
I mean, Butch Harmon's known as one of the great teachers of all time. And, you know, I mean, Mickelson left him and people, it happens. It's not,
yeah,
not the end of the world. You know, players go to other teachers when they're at a, you know, sort of beating their head against the wall and they can't get it figured out. And who knows, it could be time for him to make some changes.
Yeah. I mean, it's just inevitable really in the teacher player relationship that it's going to come to an end at some point. I mean, it's just too competitive out there, as you know, and it's too hard of a game and there's too many distractions and it's difficult to stay at that level. And, you know, it's interesting. You bring up an interesting point with him that is he being stubborn with the driver and wanting to hit the draw, you know, or is that the plan? Because I wouldn't think that would be the plan. You would think it would be to tee it down a little bit and get him, you know, get on top of it and hit some cuts. Is it that he still wants to, you know, set up and move the ball right to left? I don't know the answer to that, but boy, it is hard to watch. And he still has, it seems, that ability to score and shoot 70 when it looks like he's shooting 77.
Yep.
So I don't know. I just scratch my head and I'm just like, I can't believe something different hasn't happened. I want to ask you, when you watch, you know, Ricky Fowler, what do you see with him now in his ball striking?
You know, at times I think it's coming and I think he's getting there. You know, it's been a process for him because that's a pretty big change, you know, to go from where his backswing ended up, which is, you know, pretty laid off and flat. And,
yeah,
you know, he's trying to get that shaft a little more up vertical going back and then be able to lay it down a little bit on the way through. And that's a huge change for him. But I think he's gotten closer and I don't see him too far off. I see him a lot closer than Jordan Spieth right now. That's for sure. It seems to me that Ricky, he's in one of those places where it's still a little bit, you know, he still has to think about it a little bit out there, the swing change. And every once in a while, bad swing jumps in there and it causes a big number. And I think once he eliminates the big numbers, I think he's a lot closer to playing well again, especially than Jordan is right now. So the problem is when you go through these changes, a lot of times, if it doesn't happen right away, and if you don't see some good results right away, and you go out there and you're competing week to week on the PGA Tour, and the results aren't there, eventually it starts to chip away at that confidence that you had. You can be playing really good and the swing changes can be there and you've kind of gotten over the hump and everything should be good. But the only way you get the confidence back now is to shoot the good scores and maybe have some finishes. So it's kind of a, you know, chicken and the egg or whatever you want to call it,
yeah.
But it's not an easy thing. Confidence is a really tough thing to get back once you lose it. And the only way to do it is have good results.
Yeah. These guys, you know, it's just so competitive out there as you know, and so deep, they can't be thinking about, you know, the swing and what they're doing to be playing at that unconscious state that they've played at before. Right. And it is a process certainly to get there, but it, you know, you can see it with Ricky. The club is certainly looking a little bit better. He looks like he's kind of loading up a little bit more. He would get used to kind of spin away from that post a little bit going back. And as you mentioned, the shaft would get laid off, but it's fascinating that you play most of your career with the shaft probably steepening a little in transition. And now you're going to a phase where it shallows and, man, like that, you know, in the world of instruction, that's some wholesale stuff for sure. The other guy that I want to ask you about, and I've been saying this for a while, that I'm concerned about Justin Rose. My goodness. I mean, I've met Justin a couple of times and one of the nicest people I've ever met in my entire life, just terrific individual, you know, just the short amount of time that I got to spend with him. And then I see some of the things that he has done, you know, in his career and the changes that he is making, no longer, of course, with Sean Foley. And then, you know, I think in hindsight, probably the bit of the debacle of a changing equipment when he was the number one player in the world. And, you know, just some stuff that I look at, I'm like, man, that doesn't even kind of strike me as Justin Rose, you know, kind of making these big changes. Yep. And he hasn't looked good, Kurt, at all. you know, ball striking, we think of Justin Rose, but strokes gain, you know, when you look at him tee to green, he's in the red here in the last few months, 52nd at the CJ Cup. What do you think of Justin right now?
Yeah, it's, I agree. It's really unusual. The guy is just such a professional, and he just, you know, he works on every aspect of his game. And I mean, I just remember a couple years ago, he was playing, I think he and Rory were paired together out at Safeway, and I was out watching him, you know, before we went on the air one day. And I mean, Rose was driving it out there right with Rory all day long, and we know how far down there that is. And he was accurate, and just every part of his game, he's an unbelievable bunker player. I mean, he is so good in the bunkers. He's great around the greens. And I thought, you know, once the putting kind of got fixed, you know, a couple years ago, this guy was, I mean, that was kind of the last thing. But, you know, he, for whatever reason, he broke up with Sean Foley, and, you know, maybe he's searching a little bit now. I don't know. You know, some guys, he's had such a great career, and he's a major champion, he's an Olympic champion, and, you know, sometimes maybe they just kind of hit this wall in their career. I think he's close to 40, if he's not 40 yet. So I don't know. I think he has a lot left in the tank, don't get me wrong, but just think he's going through a stage here where golf's not quite as much fun as it was right now. He's not shooting the scores that he was, and guys have to sort this stuff out and figure out the way to go here. I wouldn't surprise me. I haven't heard. Is he working with anyone right now that you know of?
No, I mean, I think he was in Bahamas, and that's when he announced he was no longer to be with Sean. He came back, and of course the Schwab, he was third, played well, 14th at the Heritage. All right, you know, off you go. And then he misses three straight cuts. You know, he played top 10 at the PGA, but you know, it just feels like it's going the wrong way now. And it just, you know, he's showing up -3, -4 strokes gained tee to green. And that's not Justin Rose kind of play. I mean, that doesn't even sound like Justin Rose. So who knows? I mean, behind the scenes, maybe kind of get back to, he just kind of strikes me as that guy that, you know, hey, ingrain in the process, surround yourself around the right people, make good decisions, you know, like, and all of a sudden, like, we've kind of deviated from that. You know, he's in a lot of commercials. I don't know. It just doesn't completely add up to me. I will say this,
Travis, you know, at some point I wish some of these guys, especially a guy like Rose, who's in a position where financially he never has to worry about it again. I wish these guys would play the equipment that is, they know absolutely that it's the best equipment that they can put in their bag, and don't chase the extra, you know, whatever it is. I have no idea. I'm just throwing a number, you know, let's say it's a $5 million a year deal out there. You know, you've already got $75 million in the bank. You've got $100 million. I have no idea, but when you've got enough money, why not just play the absolute equipment, you know, you can play the best. So he was playing great with the equipment, you know, from like 3-4 years ago. He knew the driver, he knew the irons, he was playing the wedges, everything was great. And then he did the putter thing, you know, with that putter that he endorses now. And I thought, man, he's off and running. But I do think the equipment change was a big deal. And I think it started him in the wrong direction.
For sure. I mean, he's the number one player in the world. You know, when he made the change, I always like to play the games, like just take the name off of the situation of what just happened in front of you and ask yourself if that makes sense. You're the number one player in the world and you just switched equipment.
Yeah.
Like
you've just won the Olympics. You know, I heard, I had heard that when Rose won the Olympics, that Olympic gold medal would be worth $10 million a year minimum for him, you know, just in endorsements and, you know, fees for showing up at different things and just, you know, and I'm thinking, wow, that's unbelievable. So to your point, I mean, once you get to that point, making an equipment change is a big deal for these guys. It's not a big deal for a 10 handicapper, but it's a huge deal for a guy that's the number one player in the world.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, it'll be interesting to see. You know, we got a few big events here coming up. One of them, of course, the Masters that is just going to be fascinating to watch in November. Let me ask you real quick. Are these guys have just got to be begging to have some people on the golf course. Yeah. I mean, they have to be so ready to see some people. I mean, even Tiger. I mean, Tiger would probably welcome somebody yelling in his backswing right now.
Ready. All of these guys. Those guys thrive on galleries. I mean, you know, the Tigers and the Brooks Koepkas and the Justin Roses of the world. I mean, these guys, Ricky Fowler, they thrive on that stuff. It's like they want to show off how good they are, and they thrive on that, man. You know, that, you know, the big crowd roars when they stuff one in there from, you know, 20. It's definitely something that's lacking out there right now. It's too bad that the Masters can't have it. It's going to be really weird watching it without that gallery, especially, you know, Saturday, Sunday, the back nine, you know? So yeah, I think these guys, Tiger even talked about it, that it's something that he misses. Think about Tiger. Since when he turned pro, what, 96, has he ever played a tournament where there wasn't 10,000 people following him around a golf course? And so he thrives on that energy that he gets from these big galleries. And he even talked about it. He said it's been a little bit of a problem since the restart of golf.
Dak Prescott, you know, the quarterback for the Cowboys, opened up about it and talked about it, how he struggled with depression coming back from the pandemic. And he's not the only one. You know, you know, there's a lot of this happening in professional sports, struggling to get back to that peak performance, you know, because they're entertainers and the gallery and the fans are big motivation for that. And I there's no question in my mind on the tour, there's guys right now struggling to just get that fire lit and get out there and I'm sure perform, because that's what they do. They feed off of that injury, especially at Augusta where they line them up 12, 13 deep, you know? So it's going to be interesting to look at, you know, one guy that, you know, during the pandemic, and I have to ask you here about Bryson, who he just completely changed his body. Kurt, I talked to Greg Roscoff, who's the guy that really was the guy that put all of this together for Bryson. They've been working on this for 3 years, and it's a podcast that's going to run this Wednesday. It's really, really interesting stuff.
He's a workout guy.
And
Yeah.
So Greg Roscoff's the guy that really started with Bryson 3 years ago and just getting his body really in a position where he could start to put on weight and start to handle the speed. This has been a year and a half in the making before, you know, Bryson all of a sudden showed up after the pandemic with 40 pounds heavier. Yeah. So it was a really interesting conversation to look at. And I told him, I was like, you realize that Bryson hit it 298 yards in 2018. He hit it 322 yards in 2019 season. And in a very short sample size, he's hit it 344 yards in 2020. I mean, that's just crazy.
It's unbelievable. I mean,
that is just incredible jump. You look at this, right? Yep. You're out there. Give us some insight to Bryson, the character that he is out there. Is it, I don't know, Bryson, is it really that he is the scientist that he kind of puts off and we hear about and we see? Give us some insight on who Bryson DeChambeau is, the man.
He's 100% a numbers guy. He's a physics, a numbers guy. And so that whole process of, first of all, getting his body ready to be able to practice swinging the club as fast as he is, that was a big deal, right? You can't just go there and start swinging, you know, 135 miles an hour when you've been swinging at 118 and expect your body to hold up, because that's going to be hard on it. But he put on the muscle, you know, he did the workouts and he strengthened the area that he needed to strengthen. And now he's able to go, you know, he said the other day, he's going to hit 2,000 drivers before the Masters. He's working with a 48-inch shaft because he breaks down with the numbers. He knows that extra 3 inches or whatever on that shaft with that length of club, that's going to equate to whatever it is. Let's say it's another 20 yards. So it's a numbers game for him. He looks at strokes gained, you know, at a year ago, and he knows that if he can add 20 yards of length off the tee, that's going to equate to one shot a day or whatever the number is. You know what I mean? I mean, he's broke. He knows all these numbers. He's a numbers guy. And so he's just trying to give himself the advantage. And I mean, obviously it showed up at Wingfoot during the US Open. The guy, you know, he wasn't hitting it in the fairway, but if you're playing with him and you're hitting it 310 and he's hitting it 340, he's got wedges and nine irons and you're still back there occasionally missing a fairway, trying to hack a six iron out on the green, you're losing that battle. And, you know, he showed up in a big way, went by six, you know, and then, you know, here's a perfect example of we were rehearsing on Wednesday afternoon at the US Open. We had a big meeting, you know, Golf Channel, NBC. We have this huge meeting on Wednesday. And after the meeting, we went to rehearse. So everybody goes to their positions in their towers. And Bryson happened to be playing a practice round that afternoon, late in the afternoon. So this is like at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And so one of the cameramen, we're going around, we're looking at holes. We're looking at every hole on the golf course and the camera positions and what we're going to see and what it looks like on camera. And Bryson's on one of the greens. And so the cameraman pushes in and we see that he's got that Foresight quad that he uses. He has it out on the putting green. He's setting the ball perfectly where the quad can pick up how the ball, because of the speed of the greens and the nature of the greens at Wingfoot, he wanted to see how the ball was reacting off his putter so that the ball was having the best chance to roll perfectly off of his putter is basically what he was trying to do. So he was using his quad. I've never seen another player on a putting green using a quad, right? But this is the night before the first round. Mm-hmm. So if there was, you know, I'm assuming if there was a loft adjustment that he needed to make, or if there was anything, he was trying to eliminate that variable. He wanted the ball to roll perfectly off his putter or as close to perfect as he could get. I've never seen that before. And I mean, that's just kind of him in a nutshell. He just, you know, and then we all know what he did with Chris Como the night before the last round. He didn't like the way he was hitting it on Saturday. He went there. He was the only player out there hitting. It got dark. They turned on the lights for him at Wingfoot so that he could keep hitting balls. And he hit balls on Saturday night until he figured the dang thing out. And then we know what he did on Sunday, and, you know, the rest is history for him. I mean, he works hard, you know, that kind of hard work and the number game for him, it all works.
You're single and you have no kids, right?
Yeah.
Those are the things that that you can do. And yeah, he is working hard. I mean, I just the criticism that he has received from this, I just don't understand it. I'm like, when's the last time a professional athlete, it's a bad thing to get bigger, stronger, and faster. Like,
do you know,
why is a bad thing?
I think about the skill that it takes. They say, oh, there's no skill in how far he's hitting.
Yeah.
There is a tremendous amount of skill. If you're club head, you know this. You teach people all the time. You use TrackMan, you use Quad, you know all these numbers. But if your club head is traveling 128 miles an hour versus a guy who his club head is going 113 miles an hour, and that 113 mile an hour is producing 170 mile an hour ball speed versus 194 mile an hour ball speed. If you make a mistake going as fast as he's going, it's going to be so far offline. It is not going to be inside that cone that you want to keep it in, you know? And so there's a lot of skill in developing that talent. I admire it.
Yeah. Yeah, I do too. I mean, it's hitting it long and straight is not an easy task when you're getting ball speeds up over the 190. And what's interesting now, and after talking with Greg, I do think he's going to be the biggest we've seen him in November. And I think he'll be swinging it as hard as he has since coming back out there.
He's changing these guys' minds, right? I mean, you look at
Instagram. Yeah, oh, yeah.
You look at all these guys. In the last 2 weeks, how many top players have put an Instagram video out there of them in the low 190s with ball speed? Rory, DJ, I'm probably missing a couple, but those two in particular, they both did in the last 10 days. So he's changing some minds out there. At least they want to know they can do it, right? They want to know that they have it in there.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it's funny because like when Bryson first started going down this path, and you look at some of the comments, particularly Koepka stands out for me. And I think it did get in. I think it did get in Bryson's head to some degree. Now, the ironic part is Bryson is in everybody else's head. And to your point, you're seeing these posts. Rory's like, I just want to make sure that I can get to 190. DJ's swinging, you know, hard. You see Finau doing it. But I got to tell you that they all looked a little bit, it looked uncomfortable for them, you know, and out of control. With Bryson, it doesn't, it looks normal. So yeah, it's a fascinating conversation I had with Greg. It'll be a great listen on Wednesday. I want to do a little rapid fire here before I let you go.
Let's take a second to talk about the guys and girls over at Encore Golf. Encore has earned a reputation of having the most cutting edge technology in their golf balls that the industry has seen in quite some time. Their team in Buffalo, New York is changing the script of golf technology through the perimeter weighted designs, use of high density particles, and even a nano transitional layer in their latest creation, which offers players enhanced accuracy and control for every shot on the course and extreme velocity off the tee. They already have their award winning Elixir and Avant 55 golf balls, but the new Vero X1 is the highest performance ball to date. With their full suit of golf balls, they are transforming the game for players of all skill levels. Visit EncoreGolf.com/Travis Fulton for more details about their products that are revolutionizing the game. Now back to the Stripe Show podcast.
This is good stuff. It's a little game I like to play where we just kind of project ahead here. So I'm going to give you two names and then you got to pick one of those two and why they're going to have the better next 2 years on the PGA Tour. First one, here we go. Xander or Cantlay?
I didn't know you were going to make it this hard.
I'm sorry. Maybe I should have set that one ahead of time. Just realized that's a tough one.
I really like both of their guys' games a lot. I guess
I'm friendly with
Xander's dad, and I'm friendly with Jamie Mulligan too. So this is a really tough one for me. But I'll go. I'm just because I have to pick one. I'm going to just go with Xander, only because at this moment in time, Xander's definitely a better putter than Cantlay is right now. And Cantlay's a good putter. He's stroking everything, but right now I like Xander's putting stroke a little bit better.
That's interesting. Xander's like, he's in my top five for wanting to watch. And I didn't realize, and you guys were talking about it on the telecast, just how regarded he is by the other players and how many of them kind of label him as the top player.
He's got a lot of admirers. There's no doubt about it, you know, and it's like,
yeah.
I mean, his rookie year, right? He won at Eastlake at the Tour Championship. I mean, this guy, he's really, really good, and he's unafraid of the moment. Yeah, he made a bogey down the stretch at CJ Cup on Sunday yesterday that may have cost him his turn. You know, the tournament, he had one, you know, that drive in a bad spot underneath that tree, but he is not afraid of the moment. He's just a bulldog out there. I mean, if he's got a 10 footer for bogey, he's grinding just as if it was a 10 footer for birdie. I mean, the guy has no let up in him. Cantlay doesn't either. Back to Cantlay, but I'm gonna have to stick with Xander on this one, and I think they're both gonna have a great 2 years.
Last three tournaments for Xander: second at the Tour Championship, fifth at the U.S. Open, second at the CJ Cup. All right, next one here. Taylor Gooch or Lanto Griffin?
Next two years. I'm going to go with Lanto Griffin there because he already has the win, and I think that gives him some confidence that he knows, you know, how to get that job done. Not that Gooch can't get it done, but I think the edge for me will go with Lanto Griffin because he already has the win, and he knows what it feels like down the stretch trying to put away a tournament. And they're both really good ball strikers. Lanto's a little bit longer, I think, overall than Gooch is. So I'll go with Lanto.
All right. He'll be defending, of course, at the Houston Open, which found its home right before the Augusta, who had ever thought, in November. All right. Well, this one's, yeah, let me give you the three young guns here. And you don't have to pick, but just kind of give me some your thoughts on these three. If you want to pick, great. But, you know, these guys have been paired. Victor Wolf, who's showing the consistency that I think we were all looking for. And then, of course, the PGA champion, Morikawa. Those three.
You know, when they all came out of college together, I thought that Morikawa was, for me, was probably ranked number three. And I would have probably put Wolf number one, Hovland second, Morikawa three. But it was clear pretty quickly that Morikawa was going to be really good out here. He was just so consistent, you know, and it went up to the Barracuda in Reno and won that event. And it was just so impressive. I think the question mark was for Morikawa was he didn't win a lot his senior season at Cal. And so in college, so you kind of wondered, well, he's going to be consistent. He'll make a lot of money. Is he going to be able to win? Well, he put that to bed in a hurry. So that's kind of, you know, he's just all around every part of it. You know, his coach, I have trouble with his last name, Rick Sussinghouse. So Sussinghouse is not only a swing coach, he has a degree in psychology. So the guy pretty much covers every base there. So Morikawa, I'm very, very high on. Wolf, I love George Gankus, the enthusiasm. Wolf's a hell of an athlete. You know, we know he hits it a mile. That's the one thing that he does better than Morikawa. He hits it a mile. And Hovland has everything. Like every part of the game except for one. He is at the PGA Tour level, at his level, a tournament winner and a consistent player on tour. He might be the worst chipper of the ball that I've seen out there right now. Like pitching off of tight lies, chipping off of tight lies right now, he's not good. And he knows he's not good. So he's fine if there's grass under the ball. But I think both he and Wolf are going to both win a lot of tournaments out there over the course of, you know, the next 5 and 10 years. So is Morikawa. But you got to give the edge to Morikawa right now. I mean, anybody that wins a major championship deserves a crown as far as those three go.
You know, he never was on a launch monitor.
Is that right?
To college.
Yeah.
Morikawa. Yeah, never. And Sussinghouse has taught him for a long time. I talked to Rick about it. And he's like, yeah, we just
tell you what, looked at a number. You got as a teacher, you know? You must love the positions that he gets in. And when he, how about that? You know, I love that. Just, as long as your grip's not really, really strong, if it's a neutral grip, I love a lot of these guys, you know, in the change of directions where that left wrist starts to bow, and that really gives them control of the club face. And Morikawa's got a ton of that.
Yeah. And he played a draw most of his youth. And then he really, as I understand, didn't go to the fade until he turned pro. And that has become more of a shot for him. His swing is just fabulous. And, you know, of course, Wolf, I'll be honest. I've been a little surprised with Wolf. Not, you know, he won the 3M Open, but, you know, second at the U.S. Open, second at the Shriners, fourth at the
PGA. Those are good numbers.
I mean, that's some pretty heady stuff. Those are great numbers. I thought he would play well, but I didn't think he would play that well. And I've been surprised. And yeah, you got to shore up the chipping and the pitching with Hovland. I think what's happening there, I think is learning. And I've talked to Dana about this, Dahlquist, a little bit about this with him, is that they're learning what's the most efficient way for him to manage the hooded face a little bit, and then the leading edge interaction with the ground. You know, is he going about it like DJ does, where he opens the face up more? Or are they going to have to change the left wrist
only for those shots
during the motion?
Yeah,
only for those shots. So it clearly hasn't gotten to a good point yet, because you're not going to keep winning on the PGA Tour.
I will say this: I'm a big fan of Dana Dahlquist, and so I think they'll get it figured out. And you know, Dana, he has an ego as a teacher, just like all of you really good teachers do. But he doesn't let that get in the way. If he feels like that Hovland could be helped by another instructor with his pitching and chipping, I don't think he would have any trouble sending him over there. So they'll figure it out.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I think Josh Gregory's helping him a little. And then I seen Victor posting some swings with Jeff Smith on the speed. So there's another guy that, speaking of guys that are posting, you know, pictures of swinging it really, really hard. What about Rory or DJ? What are we going to see? I mean, DJ is a guy that has resurfaced. Unfortunate here with the COVID. Hopefully he's going to get back soon and healthy. Rory, married, child, on the way. And you know, what are we going to see from these two guys now over the next 2 years? They got to be peaked, right? Mm-hmm. With what Bryson's doing, hit that 25 yards past them. I mean, we're going to see some great golf from these two.
I mean, I really do. You know, Rory's he's working a little bit right now, swing and not playing golf like he normally does. I will say this on touching on the distance thing with Rory. You know, he posted that video, and he's, you know, I was listening to a video that one of the TaylorMade guys put out about his bag setup for the week of CJ, and he had stuck with the driver that it's stamped 10 and a half, but he's got it dialed down to 8. He's also gone to a lighter shaft, which for a guy that hits it as far as he does, that's, you know, that can be a pretty big change. So he's, you know, the lighter shaft, he's got it down to 8 degrees. I mean, and I'm watching him warm up a couple of different days out there in Las Vegas, and he is hitting it sky high with this driver. I mean, he is trying to launch it as high as he can, and the ball's going forever. So he's definitely working on the length part of that. But I think that the home life is going really well for him. I think that gives him peace of mind. I always have high expectations for Rory. I think he's going to be great for the next 5 years, you know, maybe even 10, who knows?
We need him.
He's so well spoken. He's a really good representative of the PGA Tour. There's no doubt about that.
All right. Well, I got to ask you about Tiger Woods. Of course, he's playing this week. Zozo Championship, Sherwood, defending champ. And then we're going to see him again. They go to Bermuda on the tour, and then the Houston Open. And then, of course, we've got the Masters. So 2 times in 4 weeks. What do you think? I mean, it's hard to wrap your arms around Tiger Woods. It hasn't been great in the level of play. What do you think we're going to see here, Kurt, with Tiger?
Yeah, I agree with you. It's hard to tell what we're going to get. You know, obviously so much of it depends on his health, how his back's feeling, how his body's moving. You know, but it seems like at times it's like it's kind of filtered to the average play. Well, he would consider it poor play if he's not winning tournaments. So you know, the poor play, some of that has filtered down into his putting at times too. He's not putting at the level that he was, you know, that we're used to seeing. So I think with Tiger, it's just really going to depend on how his body is moving. And I think, you know, it's getting to the point where, you know, he's not hitting it nearly as far as he was. He's going to have golf courses that require, you know, a great iron game. And then hopefully his putting gets back to what we're used to seeing, but you know, he's not hitting it anywhere near those guys that we've talked about, DJ, you know, Rory, Bryson, and those kind of guys. So, but again, you know, Sherwood is a golf course I think he could compete on because, you know, it doesn't require overwhelming length there. You know, there's some layup holes off the tee. So I wouldn't be surprised to see him play well, and especially if, and I think the weather's going to be good out there. So we'll see. I mean, to this time of year, usually the weather's really good out in Southern California. And then the Masters, you know, I mean, we know what he's capable of doing there. So, you know, hopefully he's feeling good. And, you know, it's just, if you're not getting a lot of reps, though, even if you're Tiger Woods, if you're not getting the reps competitively, I think it's hard to put it all together for that 1 week that you show up. So it'll be interesting to watch.
Yeah. Well, he showed up in the Zozo and just last year and put on an incredible display of ball striking, drove the ball, I mean, exceptionally well, iron game, always on point for the most part. So yeah, you just hope he feels good, right? You hope he feels good. He gets up, the speed is there for him, where he feels like he can go after it and feel good doing that. Love to see him get some, you know, get a little bit of confidence heading into the Masters. And as you mentioned, you know, no one knows Augusta National better than he does around that golf course. And I think you kind of hope for somewhat of warm conditions, but it could be, you know, rainy and cold as well. So it'll be interesting to see so many storylines Thank you for being out there. I mean, the tour's done a great job. The Golf Channel's done a great job. My goodness, we appreciate being able to sit down and watch golf through this difficult summer now into the fall.
Believe me, I was thankful to go back to work. I love being out there. I love being still a little bit of a part of what goes on the PGA Tour, the TV, the Golf Channel has been awfully good to me. So it was great to go back to work. I love what I do. I missed it when we were down for those 3.5 months. So I'm glad to be back.
Well, good. We were great at it. I always enjoy your the way you break it down and present it to the audience. So keep up the great work. I appreciate you coming on the podcast. This was great, and we'll do it again.